From the Korea Economic Institute in Washington, D.C., you're listening to Korean Context, news and analysis from the Korean Peninsula. Hello, and welcome to Korean Context. My name is Jenna Gibson, Director of Communications here at KEI, and I'll be your host today. We're only 2 months into 2016, but there have been some major changes on the Korean Peninsula. From North Korea's fourth nuclear test at the beginning of January to the closure of the Kaesong Industrial Complex in February, there's certainly a lot to talk about with today's guest, Dr. John Park. Dr. Park is an adjunct lecturer at the Harvard Kennedy School and a research associate at MIT. He is also a faculty affiliate with the Project on Managing the Atom at the Harvard Kennedy School's Belfer Center for Science and International Affairs. Dr. Park has been studying many different aspects of North Korea and the nuclear issue, so we're very excited to talk to him about all the things that have been happening on the peninsula lately. So let's jump right in. Dr. Park, were you surprised by how eventful the beginning of 2016 has turned out to be?
Not really. I think in terms of the events related to the nuclear test and the missile test, there had been speculation for a while, so it was a question of timing, but people were bracing for it. With respect to the latest movements, though, with the passage of the UN Security Council resolution, I think now all eyes are focused on sanctions implementation. This has been something of the holy grail where it came to getting key countries involved signing up to a resolution. But as the UN panel of experts report stated, the implementation record is pretty thin.
Right. So I was actually going to ask you about that. So to follow up, this report that just came out said that I think 39 out of 192 countries have reported their implementation and shown that they are really fully implementing the previous round of sanctions. So, you know, how does this bode for this new round of sanctions and what can be done to kind of bolster that implementation?
Right. There's a great deal of focus on China. And with respect to China's support in close coordination with the United States of the latest resolution, there is, I think, managed expectations but tempered optimism in terms of this resolution potentially being different. However, if you look at the track record, usually 3 months after the passage of a resolution in response to a particular North Korean test, the honeymoon period is about 3 months. And so I think with the evaluation of, you know, if this in fact is a different type of experience with respect to Chinese implementation, we'll know in short time. The challenges, though, are manifold. If you look at it from the perspective of China's stance in dealing with North Korea, there's always that line in terms of making sure from a Chinese perspective that any measure doesn't challenge the viability, the survival of the North Korean regime, the North Korean state. So that's something that becomes, in many respects, the early litmus test for all the other countries, if that's China's earlier line.
So far, North Korea has been conducting a nuclear test about every 3 to 4 years, beginning in 2006. Some analysts are predicting, though, that they're already gearing up for a fifth test to take place sometime in the next few months or later this year. Is 2016 about to get a lot more interesting, or do you expect another pause between the tests here?
If there is a pause, I think it'll be for technical reasons as opposed to political ones. So the technical experts say that North Korea is on a track to improving their nuclear and missile capabilities, and that's something that requires more tests. North Korea has certainly made progress in terms of increasing the yield in their nuclear tests, and it denotes perhaps improvements in their warhead design, where they're getting a higher explosive yield for miniaturized warheads, something that is a key goal for the North Koreans in that respect. On the missile development side, these ballistic missile tests have shown that North Korea has a certain type of range, but with respect to the next step of actually combining a miniaturized nuclear warhead to a proven delivery system, the North Koreans will confront another hurdle, which is having a device that can survive reentry into Earth's orbit. So I think with the hurdles ahead and the track record and whatnot, it looks like the direction arrow is to more tests as opposed to some type of pause related to either reevaluation of their strategy. And that, I think, is a source of great deal of concern for the countries in the region.
In regards to the most recent nuclear test, there is some debate about the nature of the test itself. North Korea claimed it was a hydrogen bomb. Many analysts said no way. And later on, there was some evidence that it may have been an attempt at a hydrogen bomb. So I guess my question is, how do we make policy based on so much uncertainty, secondhand information, not really getting the full picture? And how do you as a researcher weigh these different sources of information, none of which are ideal?
First off, it is, I think, a rather high bar in terms of a thermonuclear device. Although North Korea claimed that this was most recently a test that Korea had conducted with a thermonuclear device, that is a very high bar. And I think the technical community has come out and uniformly stated that it has not met that bar. That has been met with a great deal of derision in terms of this North Korean claim and having not met that claim. But what is largely missed in that type of analysis is the fact that North Korea has made progress with a fission bomb. So this idea that they're continuing on this path of looking for smaller and smaller warhead that has a higher explosive yield. So in that sense, we should, I think, pay close attention to that particular trend line. With respect to sources of information, that's always the challenge with North Korea. But one of the things that I think is quite unique, there are approximately 28,000 North Korean defectors in South Korea now, and a small handful of them are former managers of North Korean state trading companies. I think what we can discern from their experience is one of how North Korea Incorporated works, North Korea Incorporated being the constellation of North Korean state trading companies, elite companies that do the procurement activities on behalf of the North Korean regime. And from that type of information, I think we're able to piece together how the North Koreans have improved their capabilities at evading sanctions. And so this whole notion that North Korean capabilities are increasing amid a period of already increasing sanctions, and now we have more sanctions, that's a troubling puzzle that many haven't looked at in much detail.
Right. So I want to follow up on that, because that's something that is very interesting and hard to puzzle out, as you said. So with their technology getting more and more sophisticated, have the policy responses we've seen, I guess, have those proven to be ineffective in that case? Or, what can we do differently, considering that the technology is getting more sophisticated and we might have to do something to make sure that it doesn't continue on that trend?
Exactly. And in that space, we have to look very closely in terms of the initial impact of sanctions on North Korea. If you posit that the first sets of sanctions were effective, that the North Korean targets had to change the way that they did their activities, you're looking at a situation where the North Korean movement of a lot of their activities into areas inside of China present a new challenge, in the sense that it's no longer North Korean entities doing the direct procurement themselves. And that was definitely a pattern in years past. So the latest trend of North Korean entities doing procurement through private Chinese companies and other intermediaries presents, I think, in many respects, a mutation in terms of how North Korea does its procurement. So if the old ways of interdicting North Korean activities focus solely on North Korean entities, we'll still probably see instances of that happening. North Korean freighters, right now there is a freighter in the Philippines that has been detained. So those are, I think, types of evidence, pieces of evidence that show that some of these measures do work. But in terms of the procurement of the direct components that go into North Korea's WMD programs, the procurement patterns inside of China and Southeast Asia, where you're looking at these middlemen that do the procurement on behalf of North Korean clients, this is a phenomenon that definitely is growing, but the research and the knowledge that we have of these type of activities is still quite limited. Until we get better information and are able to piece these type of transactions with greater detail, I think the notion of developing and applying policy measures to try to impede and halt this type of activity on the North Korean side is still going to be somewhat mismatched. There will be a gap. But with this, I think there's an important acknowledgement that is required, that the bulk of the North Korean-focused sanctions measures are aimed at trying to disrupt and stop North Korea's ability to generate money, and money that could potentially go into financing WMD activities. If you look at North Korea's sales of coal to China, already a few years in the making, North Korea has accumulated quite large sums that they've put into accounts inside of China. So now I think the focus should increasingly be shifted in a priority sense to ways of halting the flow of the goods through these type of procurement channels, as opposed to putting the primary focus on trying to impede North Korea's ability to generate funds.
Right. And I think, didn't China make an announcement that they are kind of trying to go after some of those financial transactions more than they have in the past?
That's correct. There are a small handful of Chinese state banks that have announced they will no longer transfer funds on behalf of North Korean clients. But there also, I think we're seeing a bit of an echo. While that announcement is recent, if you look at the North Korean changes in their banking behavior, using private Chinese companies as middlemen, that I think makes it harder for Chinese banks to discern if in fact a wire transfer is somehow North Korea related. But the second thing, also the greater use of smaller regional banks by the North Korean entities as well. Those I think are harder to track in terms of trying to get compliance with sanctions measures.
So this is something that I've always been really interested in because it comes up a lot when talking about North Korea, is that in 2012, North Korea officially declared itself a nuclear state and put it into its constitution that they are a nuclear state. And as I mentioned, this comes up a lot, but I'm curious whether it really does represent, in your opinion, an entrenchment of the position, or if it's another kind of propaganda rhetoric kind of thing. How significant is it that the constitution now considers North Korea a nuclear state?
While for some, that kind of statement is the source of ridicule for North Korea, that despite having only done a small handful of tests, that North Korea now can claim itself as a nuclear weapon state, that I think is, in many respects, a type of comfort that many take in terms of those statements. However, North Korea believes, I think, in many respects, that it is a nuclear weapon state. And it has said as much in terms of its ongoing tensions with South Korea in the military space. So when you look at recent North Korean acts of provocation against South Korea using conventional means, there's a certain logic in the North Korean actions, this idea that South Korea would not dare retaliate because no country would retaliate against a nuclear weapon state. I think that's a very dangerous logic. And if North Korea were to feel even more emboldened after having conducted its most recent nuclear test, the situation, I think, changes on the Korean Peninsula in the sense that there's a greater sense of urgency in South Korea to respond to the next North Korean provocation in a very decisive manner, thinking that the greater statements from South Korea promising a larger response would deter the North Korean provocation to begin with, being the South Korean logic, going against the North Korean logic that South Korea would not dare retaliate against a nuclear weapon state, provides, I think, a situation for escalation that no one really intended.
So one of the events recently that I think, not necessarily surprised, but that people think it was very significant, is the closure of Kaesong. So I'm curious, how big of a deal do you see that closure? And do you see room to put it back on the table in the near future? How does this change the game here?
The South Korean government priority right now is to halt all sources of revenue generation for the North Korean regime. And the Kaesong industrial complex is low-hanging fruit in that sense. It's estimated that on a yearly basis, about $100 million is what South Korean companies pay in terms of wages that eventually go to the regime, a large part of that sum. However, if you follow the statements, the sense of impact for the North Korean regime is considered to be quite high. That may have been true a few years back, but the fact that now we see China-North Korea trade significantly eclipsing inter-Korean trade, if you view it from the angle of activities related to Kaesong Industrial Complex, you're seeing a situation where it would probably be more of an irritant to North Korea rather than some sort of vital threat to their survival. So with that kind of situation, the North Korean reliance on China will increase. There's already talk and rumors that North Korea is looking for other types of investors to take over in terms of where the South Koreans have left off. So there are a number of coping mechanisms that I think the North Koreans have that they didn't have if you look at it from a decade ago. But in terms of what comes next, it becomes quite tricky from a South Korean position. If there is a situation of improvement of relations between the two Koreas, you know, certainly the restarting of Kaesong could be put on the table. But it really depends on what the situation is with respect to what North Korea has found as a coping mechanism. If you see a group of Chinese investors or others having taken over Kaesong, this whole notion of somehow replacing them with the South Koreans again could be a very tricky one, even if that is feasible.
On your bio at the Belfer Center, it says that your current research is on the North Korean regime's accumulated learning in evading targeted sanctions. And you've mentioned this a little bit in your previous answers, but I'm wondering if you can elaborate and give us an idea of what exactly that means and then also what the international community can do about it.
Sure. If you look at North Korea's responses to increasing sanctions, this is an area where you see a great deal of North Korean change and modification and transformation. This is something not out of choice, but out of necessity. To give you an example, in the mid-2000s, the Banco Delta Asia incident, where the Macanese authorities in Macau found North Korean accounts in one of their banks, you saw the situation where eventually with U.S. pressure, the Macanese authorities shutting down and freezing those accounts. But with respect to North Korea, that was an important but also a painful learning experience. This idea that they wouldn't be so vulnerable in the future. So you see the beginning of a lot of migration of North Korean banking activities to areas within China. And this is an area that provides them with protection because for entities that are trying to implement sanctions, trying to go after these North Korean accounts inside of China becomes one of a sovereignty issue. This is something that I think has enabled the North Koreans to perhaps benefit with respect to their probably largest innovation in terms of how they do their banking activities. So when it comes to the improvement of evasion techniques, this is something that is driven largely by the increased application of sanctions. Previous type of activity might have been more expensive, less effective, but the application of sanctions are clearly producing this unintended negative consequence in that North Koreans find other ways of doing things. The main finding from the research is that North Koreans are using private companies as middlemen with respect to their procurement activity and as well as their financing activity, which makes detection that much more difficult.
So it's really interesting because it's one of those things that you could almost look at as a glass half full, glass half empty problem here. So on one hand, you know, you've made it a lot harder because they've gone into these private companies, they've made it harder to detect. But on the other hand, doesn't that kind of mean that the sanctions worked in the first place?
It all depends on your metric for sanctions, and there is no uniform set of metrics. In some instances, for some governments, there are very subjective metrics to show that something is being done and that there are some successes along the way. But with respect to this type of change of behavior, I think the notion of a mutation also comes to mind in the sense that changing behavior to the point where a previous policy instrument becomes less effective is something that I think we're seeing more and more signs of. With respect to the use of these private Chinese companies, it's not all benefit for the North Koreans. In many instances, this results in higher commission fees, more expenses for the North Korean entities. But with the vast sums that the North Koreans have accumulated from their coal trade with China, they now have more resources to apply to finance these type of transactions themselves. So we're looking at a situation of North Korea being very different from where they were 10 years ago. If in the minds of policymakers, the unveiling of new rounds of sanctions and even new measures are done with the North Korea of 10 years ago in mind, then the gaps, I think, will become pretty apparent pretty soon.
So last week's episode, we talked with Bill Newcomb and Daniel Wirtz, and they were kind of comparing and contrasting the U.S. and the U.N. sanctions, the new round. And one thing that we talked about a lot was the fact that the U.S. sanctions have this new interesting provision for human rights that's not really seen in previous rounds of sanctions. So as someone who studies the sanctions in ways that North Korea has gotten around them, I guess, how much does it matter that we put something about human rights in there as opposed to the more targeted financial things that are also going on?
Including measures related to human rights is important, but the immediate concern relates to the unintended negative consequences of sanctions to humanitarian activities. There's a phenomenon called de-risking, where private entities, having not violated any sanctions measures, is concerned about future reputational damage or sanctions measures changing in the future and retroactively affecting their businesses. these private entities engaging voluntarily in something that relates to essentially cutting off all business associations that have something to do with North Korea. In the case of humanitarian organizations, where they are wire transferring funds to purchase humanitarian goods or shipping material and so forth, in the case of NGOs that deal with public health, shipping medicines and so forth, the fact that these private entities will not touch any of these parts of the transaction have left some key humanitarian organizations stranded. This is something that is known by the governments involved, and in instances where humanitarian organizations go to the U.S. government, usually issues a waiver, a letter, stating very clearly that this humanitarian organization and its activities do not in any way relate to a violation of sanctions. Despite that, private entities still want to steer clear of these type of activities. That is having a profound impact in the sense that you're looking at groups within North Korea, very vulnerable groups, who are solely dependent on these humanitarian organizations, where disruption isn't something that can be remedied by an increasing of supplies later on. So, for example, in public health, multi-drug resistant TB and the medications needed for that, any disruption in the treatment timeline can be lethal for the patients. This is, I think, a very urgent priority that governments involved, particularly the United States and South Korea, need to pay more attention to, because there are repercussions down the line that there will be regret, but something where the warning signs and all of the concerns had already been raised. So with this, sanctions, as much as they're allotted for being targeted, the de-risking phenomenon is growing, and that, I think, needs to be addressed in a more robust, proactive manner.
We're close to the end here, but I want to give you a chance to say any closing thoughts about, you know, things we should be looking out for in the next few months, considering that the first 2 months of 2016 were so interesting. What do you see for the next couple months here on the Korean Peninsula?
Right now, there's a great deal of focus on THAAD, the Terminal High Altitude Air Defense System that the U.S. and South Korea are talking about in terms of deploying to South Korea. This has elicited a type of response from China that, frankly, is unprecedented. The amount of pressure that China, both discreetly and overtly, has been applying on South Korea is very much unprecedented. This is something that ties into the larger strategic outlook in the sense that South Korea is in a position that I think merits a great deal of strategic analysis, but the realities of the short term, I think, have led to prioritizations that you're seeing a stop-and-go type of approach to discussions about that. THAAD is going to raise the stakes in the sense that a defensive capability is viewed by China as a threat, not because of the missiles that would be used to potentially take out a ballistic missile that would be a threat to South Korea, but rather the radar capability of the THAAD system that could essentially, from a Chinese perspective, very concerned about the radar being perceived to be able to peer into vast portions of China. So this is an area that we're going to have to look very closely at because the ramifications are pretty serious in terms of relations in the region that start initially about North Korea and then become about a larger geostrategic reality.
Okay, great. Thank you so much, Dr. Parr, for joining us today. It was a really great discussion. We hit on a lot of really important topics, so it was great to have you.
Thank you very much.
That's all for this episode of Korean Context. As always, thank you so much for joining us for this great conversation. Please remember to subscribe on iTunes or wherever else you get your podcasts. And do remember that you can go back and listen to our archive of episodes at keia.podbean.com. Thanks again for joining us, and we'll be back again next week with another great episode.